Hello and welcome to Volume 52 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll talk about a decision a paper company has made that could affect whether it wants your timber or not. We'll talk about how organizations come together. We'll take a look at some new forestry gadgets. And we'll hear from a guest who can tell us about what you need to do now to improve your hunting land. I'm Hayes Brown, the General Counsel of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. Recently, Bow Waters, the venerable forest products company headquartered in Canada, entered into an agreement with certain environmental groups to agree not to purchase timber grown from certain types of property. And while you might think we're talking about the rainforest or some other site of special significance, we're actually talking about an agreement not to buy wood from landowners who convert hardwood to pine after 2007. Here to explain this puzzling development is Matt Bennett. Hello, Matt.
Hi. Good morning. How are you?
Matt, did I say that right? What's behind this?
Well, I think that you pretty much captured the gist of the situation. Bow Water down in southeast Tennessee had been receiving a lot of criticism from the Chattanooga press, from local environmental groups, and maybe even a little bit from the state, for something that I don't really think that they were to blame for, but there is a lot of harvesting going on in that area. Those hardwood forests down there are fairly mature and probably needed to be harvesting. In addition to that, there was quite a bit of southern pine beetle damage there, which I think most people understood that the trees were dying and they needed to be removed. But visibly, you know, there were suddenly huge expanses out there of clear-cut land that didn't have anything, and so it sort of magnified the public's impression that the entire Cumberland Plateau was about to be cut. The conversion of hardwoods to pine, I always thought was sort of a straw man. I never really saw that much of that going on. But anyway, to try to, actually, I think Bow Water made a business decision to give in to the green mail or black mail that the environmental groups were holding over them in an attempt just to get them off their back.
What are the consequences of the agreement?
Well, according to the Memorandum of Understanding, which, by the way, is not a legally binding document, it's just an agreement, Bow Waters agreed after 2007 not to convert any more hardwoods to pine, and they've also agreed not to buy any wood from anybody who, after 2007, any private landowners that have clear-cut their land and converted from hardwood to pine. So it can have an implication there for private landowners.
Does that mean that does the conversion have to occur after 2007, or they just won't buy wood that was converted at any point in time?
It's a little vague, but the way I understand it, it's the conversion takes place after 2007.
Okay. What is the likelihood that other paper companies would follow Bow Water's lead in this?
They're pretty good, actually. We've seen this green mail play out with office supply people, hamburger places, banks, and basically after you get the first one to do it and they come out, and then of course the environmental groups brag on how enlightened they are and how great everything is going to be, and really the other corporations take a look at what Bow Water or Burger King or Staples or whoever gave up to, and they see that it really didn't amount to anything that could possibly affect their bottom line. They like that PR, and so I wouldn't be at all surprised if another smaller company comes on board before very long. Whether you get Weyerhaeuser, GP, some of those guys, that may be a little bit more of a struggle, but it's really a win-win situation for the corporations.
Now, now a lot of the forest land's being bought by TIMOs. Why do you think it could affect the TIMOs that are purchasing some of this company land?
Well, it's pretty obvious that there's a you know, the trend for the paper companies is to become more of a marketing, merchandising type of business model and turn over the land management to TIMOs. Now, what I don't under or other large managers, what's kind of puzzled me about this thing is up to this point, the environmental groups have left those folks alone. And at one, you know, somewhere along the way, they're going to wake up and realize that all this land no longer belongs to a Kimberly-Clark or a GP or whatever, and they'll come after them. It's going to be interesting to see how they react.
Okay. Thanks, Matt. We appreciate you contributing. Frank Stewart is a perennial guest of Capital Ideas Live, and we've asked him to comment on the concept of biofuels. Hello, Frank.
Hi.
What is it about biofuels that should be of interest to forest owners?
Well, it's a creation of a new market for our commodities. You know, as a forest owner, you may not have bought your property necessarily to harvest, but we find statistically that most owners, if not all, do at one time or another harvest, and either for tuition, for children, or for retirement.
Mm-hmm.
And that market is important also because we are seeing a trend, I should say, a trending offshore for the pulp and paper industry. In 20 years, we may not have as much market in that traditional source for purchasing raw materials from the forest.
Mm-hmm. So the biofuel market could potentially help or replace that. There was an Energy Policy Act that President Bush signed recently. What does this do to the idea of biofuels?
Well, we're most interested in what we're calling woody biomass.
Mm-hmm.
That's our trees. And this one was significant, and it made the first steps, first big steps toward biomass in general. $3.6 billion is going to be authorized, or we hope will be authorized, for biomass, bioenergy, and biorefinery research. And it's going to double the volume of renewable fuels in the nation by 2012. That means that soon we'll be getting 25% of our transportation fuels from biomass or biofuels.
Okay, including woody biomass, which is what
we hope woody biomass.
Yeah.
We're a little lag behind there. We do expect to see in the future a woody biomass bill, or hope to see one.
Okay. Well, that leads me to the next question. What do you think's next on the horizon for forestry as it relates to energy policy?
Well, we hope to incentivize people who would want to make capital expenditures, create refineries or other bio-based conversion facilities to create energy, both fuel energy and our electricity. By the way, the bill for us talks about fuel more than energy.
Mm-hmm.
And we would, some speculation is that not everything has to be a tax credit, that we could accelerate depreciation for investments in equipment. We could highlight areas like the Black Belt that are underdeveloped economically. And we could give incentives and attaboys and thank yous to our returning veterans like they did after World War II to get them interested and give them a leg up in this developing new industry that we think is an opportunity for everyone.
Okay. Well, that's fuel for thought. Thank you, Frank. Appreciate you joining us. One of the phenomena we've examined on this program is the effect large-scale government programs have had on the timber market, such as cost share for planting. CRP programs come to mind. Some of these CRP trees are midway through their contract periods, and Uncle Sam is offering additional money for mid-contract management. Wes Berger is with us to explain. Wes, is that right? There's cost share money available during the midpoint years for CRP trees?
That's exactly right, Hayes. There's nearly a million acres of mid-rotation pine trees in the CRP program in the Southeast. Alabama has nearly 200,000 acres that are in their second contract period, and most of these trees are 15 to 17 years old. Most of those stands have been thinned, and they're eligible for some additional management practices that will enhance both the wildlife value as well as the tree growth and yield.
What are some of the additional treatments that are approved under the mid-contract program?
the federal guidelines are very broad, and each state develops their own guidelines. In Alabama, some of the mid-contract management practices that are approved for cost share are prescribed burning, fertilization, and pruning. In addition to that, you can also interseed native grasses and legumes. In contrast, in Mississippi, we've got prescribed fire, strip disking, and selective herbicides. So it varies a little from state to state.
What would the sign-up process be like if someone were going to take advantage of the program?
To get the cost share for mid-contract management, it has to be in your approved conservation plan of operation. Every CRP contract has a CPO, as they call it, and all that's required is going into your USDA service center, that's your FSA and NRCS office, and speak with your FSA representative and request to modify your CPO to allow inclusion in mid-contract management, make you eligible for cost share.
Okay, you got to modify your program. What does the government see in the value of adding additional funds for this mid-contract treatment?
They're investing in those stands primarily to enhance their environmental benefits. That's a government-subsidized forestry practice. And when we do these mid-contract management practices, we enhance the wildlife value on those stands, and the government sees that as providing societal environmental benefits. Plus, it's benefit to the landowner. It enhances their growth and yield.
Okay. Wes, we appreciate you sharing your thoughts on this. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
If your phone rings after dinner and it's a landman for a gas company offering to lease your land, you may feel somewhat alone and uninformed. Buck Watley is a landowner who organized a group of landowners to share some information and respond to offers to lease his land for methane gas exploration. Hello, Buck.
Hey, Hayes. How are you?
Why did this group that you helped organize, why did they decide to organize?
Well, it all started back in the late 80s, Hayes, when there was a big gas and oil boom here in Alabama. And we began to, various ones of us began to get these phone calls you mentioned. And the strength in numbers. And so I called some of my close neighbors, and we got together and we then discussed what the terms were that these companies were offering us and so forth. And the group grew and grew, and finally we represented 64,000 acres here in the county. Got some extremely good terms from the gas and oil companies as a result of this organization.
For others that might want to do a similar thing, take us through the steps that your group actually took to organize. How did that take shape?
Okay, yeah. First thing is I called my neighbor across the field, and we got together and down at my lake, actually, and had a couple of beers and talked about it. And then we decided we'd call other neighbors, and we have a little building community club, house that we meet at once a month. And we just decided we'd start meeting there and discuss this, and then we invited some of the representatives of the various gas and oil companies in to meet with us. And down the road, fairly soon, we decided we'd better get some legal advice, so we got an attorney in Tuscaloosa who agreed to represent us. And it just went from there.
Well, after participating in this for a while, did you see any benefits from having a group like that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Our upfront bonus money was increased substantially. We got, to that time, unheard of royalties. Unfortunately, the bubble burst before much production. Methane gas proved to be not a viable thing at that time here in this part of Alabama. It's coming back now, and I'm right now working on another group to deal with this same thing. But we got better terms on the lease, better treatment of our land, better protections, and what have you, by speaking as a group rather than individually.
Okay. Thanks, Buck. We appreciate you sharing your thoughts on that, your experiences. Well, speaking of organization, your family is an organization of sorts, especially if it owns forest land together. Clint Bentz is with us to offer some tips on keeping open lines of communication within the family with the hope that every member will be pulling in the same direction. Hello, Clint.
Hey, Hayes.
Why do you think it's important to have regular family meetings?
Well, as we all know, running a family business is really hard work, and we need to have some sort of a medium to have regular communication with each other. You know, families operate differently than a business does. You know, a family is based on blood. You're born into a family. Your family members aren't necessarily people that you would choose to be friends or even business partners. And because a business is based on performance and achievement, and that inherently brings conflict when you're trying to operate a business that is based on performance, based on achievement, and then you have these partners that are your family members. So we just need to have some dedicated time set aside regularly so we can learn how to work together as owners. It also provides a great opportunity to educate and inspire the next generation of owners, because our family forests are multi-generational enterprises. They here in the West, it's 60 years from planting to harvest. That's a three generations from planting to harvest. So we have to keep our families together through that process.
Why is there such a struggle to have these meetings and have them come out successful at the end?
Well, I find it's really difficult for families to talk together and come to agreement on difficult issues. You know, we all want to avoid conflict, and it's a challenge for families, especially I find the generation that owns most of this land. You know, they grew up with the kind of the John Wayne model, and where you didn't talk very much, and you assumed lots of things got passed on, and they really didn't. And so it's struggle to talk. Also, as kids, it's the last time, you know, we spent any quality time together was when we were in high school. And so I don't know, in your family, you get together and you kind of have a tendency to slip into old habit patterns. You know, you relate together the way you did, you know, when you were a kid. And sometimes those habit patterns aren't very good. We also see people, they don't feel that their input is valued. Mm-hmm. And so they maybe see this, you know, they come and so they kind of say, well, why am I here? This is mom and dad's deal. It's not my concern. And I think as a parent, it's really hard to talk about our closely held values and beliefs with our adult children. It's stuff we don't talk about very often, and it's just hard to talk about it. And if you don't have some sort of a model that you can work from, it is a challenge.
Could you speak briefly to the idea of how a goal can help you accomplish a better meeting?
Yes, I think every time we get together, we need to have a couple of goals. Number one, we just need to have a goal that we want to build friendship, love, and trust between the family members. Mm-hmm. That needs to be one of our major goals for our meeting, and they need to be structured that way. We also need to have a goal to educate our family members in the business of the business. And finally, at every meeting we get together at, we want to share our passion and our commitment for the land and for our family. We've posted some ideas, some guidelines up on the website at AFOA that people can link to and take a look at. I found they've been very helpful for my own family in our meetings and also with the clients that I have.
All right. Thanks, Clint.
Thank you.
Some aspects of tree quality are observable to the eye, such as straightness and natural pruning, but others, such as wood density, are not so obvious. Mark Gibson with the Louisiana Tech School of Forestry can give us some ideas to consider. Hello, Mark.
Good morning, Heath.
How do you think a forester might look at wood quality different from that of a wood products manufacturer who sees the product at the end after it's cut?
Well, quality is different things to different people, Hayes, and the forester generally looks at it from a visual appearance standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, they're interested in growing tall, straight, cylindrical stems that don't have a whole lot of taper, if possible. And volume production is one of their major goals. They want to produce the largest tree in the shortest amount of time. Whereas the manufacturer relates more to the physical characteristics of the wood that are produced within the tree and how the properties of that wood impact their particular production process. most of the characteristics and properties that you deal with on the manufacturing side, you can't accurately predict from the outward appearance of the stem.
All right, so one looks to the outside, the other looks to the inside.
Right.
What are some characteristics that are commonly used to define wood quality, no matter who you might be?
Well, I think we have several things that we can look at. One of those, as you mentioned before, is density, or the mass or the weight per unit volume of material. The denser the wood is, typically the stronger and stiffer it's going to be in a product. Variation of that density is another factor, where we have in trees, we have growth rings that are made up of early wood and late wood, early wood in pines at least being the lighter colored wood, the late wood being the darker colored bands. And they have different densities. Early wood has low density, late wood has high density. Well, in the machining process, for instance, late wood, being much denser, machines differently than the early wood, which is the lower density.
Mm-hmm.
In a floor, for instance, we have different wear patterns. The denser wood, the late wood, wears less than the early wood. So after a long period of time, you may see, you know, higher ridges in your floor, which would be the late wood. So density variation is one thing that we look at from a quality standpoint. Ring width, or the number of rings per inch, mm-hmm. is another factor. Wide rings generally were thought to indicate low density, but that's not necessarily true. Density really depends on the proportion of late wood present in a growth ring. So higher amounts of late wood in a growth ring generally relate to higher density.
And knots, is that an issue?
Yes, knots is also a problem. Knot size, for instance, how large the knot is, whether it's a tight knot that's intergrown into the wood, or whether it's a loose knot that may fall out, and where those knots are placed in the piece of wood also makes a big difference in the product.
Well, what do forest landowners do that can affect wood quality either for good or for ill?
Well, one thing I think all forest landowners need to understand is that both tree growth and wood formation are controlled by factors like site, climate, genetics, competition with other trees, and those factors interact in a really complex and sometimes unpredictable fashion when we relate that to wood quality. Things like genetically improved planting stock, which most people are using now, generally result in improved growth or better form of the crown, stem, and branches. Characteristics of genetically improved stock can basically will tend to yield higher wood quality. But things like planting density also make a big difference. If you plant on a low density where you have wider spacing in the initial planting, typically we end up with larger diameters, shorter trees, not as tall. We may have more early wood present in the growth rings and potentially less juvenile material, which is a problem that we run into in all trees.
Mm-hmm.
Typically in the low planting densities, we have bigger knots, less clear wood in the products, and overall more taper, which can relate to cross grain in lumber products especially.
And that planting is something that the forester oftentimes makes the decision, not the wood products manufacturer.
That
you've got to think ahead to the end.
Yeah, and something that the forester needs to be concerned about and thinking what his intermediate products are and what the final product that he's going for is. Different products require different quality, essentially. And so if we know kind of where we're headed with these, and sometimes that's not always easy to do.
Okay. Well, thanks, Mark. We appreciate you highlighting those topics, the things to keep in mind.
Yeah, thank you.
Technology is now no stranger to the forestry business, as we see new products that enter the market each year. Many of these products are GIS, or Global Information Systems, such as one product that's called FGIS. Stephen Prisley can introduce the gizmo to us. Hello, Stephen.
Hello. Hey, how are you?
Tell us about FGIS and how it works.
Well, FGIS is one of these geographic information system software packages. GIS is generally software that manages spatial data, like map-type data, which could include aerial photographs, satellite pictures, or scanned maps like the USGS TopoQuads people are used to using. or any other kind of additional spatially related data. A GIS can manage that, display it, allow a user to interact with it, to create maps that they want, turning on and off different layers such as roads or streams to show up over a background. The software can be used to calculate area, for example. It could be used to measure distances. And in addition, it can work like a database where, for example, foresters might or landowners might want to digitize all their forest stands and keep records about activities that occur on those stands, like silvicultural treatments. So it serves as a database as well as a mapping display system.
Okay. And you've corrected me. It's actually Geographic Information System. That's
right.
The G in GIS. How might this software be a benefit to a private landowner that owns several hundred acres?
Well, it's somewhat like the more complex your financial investment situation is, the more you could use investment management software. And similarly, the more complex your land ownership situation is, the more this might benefit you. But even with fairly simple situations, a landowner might be able to download publicly available aerial photographs, for example, of their property, pull them up, draw maps with them. They could use these maps to communicate with others, maybe communicate with a consulting forester or somebody who's working on their land. Let's say you want to locate areas on your land. You can use these little recreation-grade GPS receivers, the global positioning system receivers, that many hunters and fishermen use. You can use those to collect coordinates that then could be plotted over an aerial photograph, for example, and whether that might be a deer stand or whether it might be a beetle kill spot in your woods, you can use these to create maps.
It sounds like there is some additional input that the landowner needs to load onto the system. Where does he get this data that he's supposed to use with this software and equipment?
Right. There's a huge amount of digital data that's freely available across the Internet. There's a couple of links on the AFOA website now to link to these with Alabama state agencies like the State Water Program or the Geological Survey of Alabama. In addition, almost all federal agencies with any kind of land management have digital spatial databases, including anything like roads, streams, county boundaries, land survey grids. All this kind of data is available free digitally on the Internet.
Okay. Thanks, Stephen. David Edwards is a wildlife biologist for Westervelt Services. Hello, Dave.
Hi. How you doing?
Dave, many landowners are now making preparations to plant wildlife food plots. This is a conversation recorded in August, so this is the right time to do something. What do you think they ought to be doing right now?
Well, it really depends on what their goals are. A lot of things they need to be doing now is planting, but as far as what to plant, there's two different strategies. One is whether the landowner is actually trying to attract deer or turkeys or things of that nature, or are they trying to feed them. On attraction plots, you want something that's real attractive, like wheat, oats, rye, that type of stuff. On the feeding side of it, you want to try to get some perennial-type food plots in that can provide a food source throughout the year. So there's a couple of different goals, and most of the clients or landowners that I work with or Westervelt works with, they kind of want a good combination of both. So we generally will recommend putting in maybe 60% perennial food plots, which are going to be providing a good food source for wildlife throughout the year, and 40% of their food plots in annuals. And the annuals are the attractants, to get them out in front of folks so they can observe them, see them, or harvest them, something like that.
Okay. Well, I'm seeing a lot of infrared cameras now in the woods. It's become real popular. How do these work, and what kind of information can you get from a census that you use cameras to collect?
Yeah, that's really become real popular, and it's just a tremendous tool, just a great tool for a landowner to use to assess the status of their deer herd. And what that does is allows them to see what's going on with it then, and based on their goals, they can make some management decisions, and it helps them give something to shoot towards, whether they need to balance sex ratios or what have you. The camera censuses are they're basically run for about 10 to 14 days, and the time you want to do a camera census is obviously when the lowest food is available, natural food in the woods, because you don't want to be competing with acorns or other crops coming up, food plots or anything. So we generally will run our camera census in the fall between the time bucks shed velvet off their antlers and when the acorns start falling. And also, to run a camera census, just to give you a quick idea, is to set up a property, you will basically put out one per 100 acres, a bait site. And then from there, you'll bait the deer with whole corn for a couple weeks. Place cameras on all these bait sites. So if you have a 2,000-acre place, you may have 20 bait sites. Mm-hmm. And you'll set up 20 cameras and run them for 10 to 14 days. And generally, from what we can tell, we're getting 90% of the deer that are actually using that property at that time. But very useful information, too.
Give us a quick word on doe harvest. Is that an important tool for landowners?
Oh, absolutely. As quality deer management's gotten more and more strong, more folks practicing it through the Southeast, doe harvest has certainly become important. And we're having to do a lot of education because a lot of folks have not shot does in the past. Now they're starting to shoot them. So now we're having to kind of educate them on how to differentiate an adult doe from a fawn and also which does to shoot.
Okay.
And got a few strategies that we normally go through with a landowner to help them try to avoid shooting button bugs. And a couple of them I can share with you that I can think of.
Give us a couple of ideas on differentiating button bugs from does.
Yeah. Basically, you can look at a deer's body just about from any distance, and an adult deer will have a rectangle-shaped body from the ground level to the middle of their body and from the tail to their chest. Fawns will have a square-looking shape, and that's been very useful, probably my number one indicator on looking at a fawn or an adult. Also, fawns will have long ears and short faces. Button bucks will generally have a flat spot between their ears versus a more of a rounded head. So that's little things you can look for. As far as strategies on trying not to shoot or trying to shoot the doe and not make a mistake, probably number one is never shoot a deer that's by itself.
First one in the field might be a button buck. Right?
That's right. That's right.
If they're by themselves.
That's right. So we generally will recommend folks to wait, let some other deer show up, so you can have some other bodies to compare against, and obviously don't shoot in low light. And probably the other top thing is if you're not sure, don't shoot.
Okay.
And just give the animal benefit of the doubt.
All right. Thanks, Dave.
Okay.
Well, that's all the time we have for this issue. Our thanks go to Matt Bennett, Frank Stewart, Wes Berger, and Buck Watley. We also appreciate the contributions of Clint Vince, Mark Gibson, Steve Brisley, and Dave Edwards. Sociologists usually define power as the ability to impose one's will on others, even if the others resist it in some way. Bowater's Paper Company has exercised its power to refuse wood grown from pine plantations that were once hardwood forests. Whether this is deeply disturbing or a cause for celebration depends on your perspective. Whatever your perspective, this move underscores the differences between non-industrial forest owners and the timber industry. One has shareholders and a public reputation, and the other has a family table and its own sense of community pride. Have forest owners been betrayed by their elite, this elite gaining for a time the faint praise of the environmental lobby? Will this really accomplish anything lasting, or will this merely increase the appetite of those that would like to put an end to all timber harvesting? One paper company has answered that question for itself. We'll see if others join this trend or take advantage of the wood that Bowaters refuses to buy. This international paper has just decided to move its headquarters to Tennessee. We may find out sooner rather than later. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown, thanking you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.